Hi, I'm Stephen Downs. I'm online live right now at the OCC 2007 conference. I'm just listening to George as he speaks here. He's introducing me now. And in a few moments, I'll be beginning my presentation to the OCC conference. So there may be a few minutes of silence here while I wait for George to finish, and then you'll hear the session get going. Thank you, George. Thank you. Hello, everybody. We've got a pretty good-sized crowd here, which is appreciated. Thanks for showing up on a Thursday for some of you morning and some of you afternoon, and for those of you in the Eastern time zone, Thursday at lunchtime, which I'm very impressed by. The title of my talk is The Recognition Factor. The talk breaks down into five major sections, and George, what I'll do is I'll talk about each of these sections, and each section, maybe 10 minutes or so, give or take. I'm going to try to aim for that, and then we'll have some discussion after each one of these sections, if that sounds all right. I will also, from time to time, as I'm proceeding through the sections, turn off the microphone and pause for a few seconds, in case anybody wants to jump in at that point. That was an example of me pausing. And especially George, you should feel free to jump in at those pauses, and other people, if the spirit really moves you, keeping in mind we've now got 111 participants and a limited amount of time. Where I'm going to begin is from the context, at least for me, the context of some of the discussions that we've been having online recently about whether connectionism is a new theory. And what I'm going to say is that a lot of the stuff that I have to say in my talks is stuff that you already know, things that you've already seen. You listen to some of the things that I would have to say about learning, you'll say, well, so-and-so said that. There's nothing new there. And this is quite true. But what I'm trying to do with this talk in particular, rather even than construct some sort of argument or inference or something like that, I'm trying to get you to see it differently, to see it more clearly, so that when you go back and you look at the everyday sorts of things that I talk about or that George talks about or other people talk about, you'll see them differently. You'll see them in a different light. For example, you should see in front of you, assuming that Illuminate is working, a nice little green man standing on a planet looking at the sky. And this is a scene we've all seen, right? The night sky, the sun's just sort of setting off to the right there, the stars are filling the sky, and we ask, which ones are the planets? Well, if I talk about stars and I talk about planets, you say, well, yeah, you're not talking about anything new. But if you change your perspective, you look at things differently, from a different light, you tilt your head, then you can see the patterns underlying the picture. We're standing on the surface of a planet, a round planet, at about 55 degrees. That's the angle of the tilt there. And so the horizon, you see, sort of picture ourselves on the edge of this planet. And we can imagine in our mind the orbits of the planets around the sun. You see the sun now setting off to the right. And now the planets are very easy to spot, because all the planets orbit the sun in a plane, the orbital plane. And so you just pick out the bright little dots that are on that orbital plane. Now the idea here isn't to teach you how to spot planets, although you'll find that a useful skill in the future, I hope. The idea here is to show you that even something very familiar that's right in front of you can look different if you look at it in a different way. And this example, to give proper credit, comes from Paul Churchland. My theory of learning is very simple. My theory of learning is to teach is to model and to demonstrate, and to learn is to practice and to reflect. There's no shortcuts here, there's no magic solutions, there's no magic wands. You're not going to get more of it if you throw more funding at it, less of it if you throw less at it. It's just a very simple theory, and that's in my mind because brains are at heart very simple. And of course it's something you've seen before. But we get to the heart of it. We ask, to model what? To practice what? What is it that we're supposed to be doing? And that's the topic that I'm trying to get at. That's what I'm trying to draw out and to get you to see. Here's a little example. Suppose we want to teach people the concept of brackets in mathematics for some reason. And we have an example. There's the example up on the blackboard there. And I ask you, to teach the concept of brackets, would you use this one example over and over? And pretty clearly, no, you wouldn't use the same example over and over. Nobody would do that. That would be insane. But the question is, why not? Because if teaching is nothing more than the transfer of knowledge from one person to the other, we should be able to manage it just by doing the same thing over and over. But of course, what we're trying to do here is to teach a concept, not a fact. And a concept is something that's deeper than what you see in any given example. It's something that underlies the example. The question here now is the concept for brackets, for spelling, or for architecture, or whatever, best thought of as a rule that we can teach people, you just tell them what the rule is and they follow it, or is it a pattern? And as I'm sure you can imagine from the title of this talk, I'm going to argue that it's a type of pattern. I'm going to pause here, and I know I don't seem to have covered a whole lot, but I still want to pause here and see if there are any comments. Okay, and I see we're getting some great comments here and questions in the chat area. Can a concept or a pattern be thought of as a sort of a rule? And what I'm going to argue in this section, section number two, is that there's a very fundamental difference between things that are like patterns and things that are like rules. And we get at that by the concept of representation. What we're most used to, as far as representation is concerned, is the model I've got here on the picture in front of you. We have a word, tree, and that stands for a tree. And what you're supposed to notice here, first of all, it's symbolic, it's a symbol system. And secondly, we have a one-to-one relation here. Like the word stands for the thing. The thing is represented by the word. Now, of course, you can have one word standing for a class or a group of objects, but the point here is that the word is atomic. There isn't something that is part of the word tree that continues to represent things. Right? You have letters, but letters don't stand for anything by themselves. Distributed representation, on the other hand, is something that's very different. We have the same tree. And we look at the network there that we see in the upper right. And the tree is represented not by something atomic, not by something that is a symbol, but rather by a set of connections. And I've highlighted, just for the example here, the connections in red. And what you want to notice here is that there's no one thing that is the representation of tree. That there's actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 connections, and it looks like 7 individual units or neurons there. Also, and this is really important, the very same network with the very same set of connections and the very same units or neurons actually represent various things. So we have the representation of the tree as we had before, but the very same collection of neurons is a representation of a puppy, a nice cute puppy. That's what turns up on Google if you search for puppy or a couch. And so if you think about sentence-based or symbol-based representation, right, the word for tree doesn't mingle in with the word for couch at all. They're two separate things. The meaning of the word tree is distinct from the meaning of the word couch. But on something like this, if you change the meaning of the word tree, it's also changing the meaning of the word couch, even though semantically they are not related at all. So there are, in a distributed representation, connections or associations between concepts that would also seem to us to have nothing to do with each other. Here's the theory. Concepts are not words, and that's why it's not going to be a rule-based system. They are patterns in a network, a network like the mind, the human brain, or a network like society as a whole. In these networks, there's no specific place where the concept is located. The concept is distributed as a set of connections across the same network. And other concepts are embedded in the same network. They form parts of each other, and they affect each other. So that's part two, and I'll pause here at this point to see if there are any comments or questions. I am going through this a bit faster than expected, but I think that's okay. Questions on the comments that are coming up. What I'm going to do is defer that question to later on in the presentation. Right now, I simply want to establish that concepts are patterns. Okay. The short answer, I guess I'm not deferring it, am I? The short answer is that the principles that govern the operation of rules are sentential principles. They're logical principles. They are principles of symbol systems. And these principles are different than the principles that govern operations of patterns. And to express that sort of difference in, if you will, a slogan type form, symbol systems are based on the concept of equality, the concept of identity. This is that. Patterns are based on the concept of similarity. This is like that. And that's the short version of the answer. Right, and as was indicated in the comments, or not in the comments, but in the discussion in the Moodle threads, constructivism, to my understanding of it, is based in physical symbol systems. You don't get constructivism without symbol systems. And since this is not a symbol system theory, it is not constructivism. Pretty minimally. My take on this, and we may have to back this around a bit, sure. Connectionism is a theory, a computational theory that's been around for quite a while. It's the principle of how patterns in networks are recognized, and then we can go on and start talking about that. Connectivism adopts all of that. All of connectionism is absorbed by connectivism. And then connectivism becomes the study of how we use this knowledge of connectionism, in a pedagogical sense. I've represented it in the past, although I don't think you liked this. Connectivism is the pedagogy of connectionism. That would be my take on it right now. But at heart, I'm a connectionist. I mean, my roots are in connectionism. That's not a bad characterization. I'm not sure that is the distinction that would have been intended, but that's kind of how it happened. A lot of the discussion of networks that occur in society fall under the heading of discussions of social networks, and so you get people like Duncan Watts and others, and you're looking at stuff like scale-free networks and all of that. And you're quite right, the connectionist literature focuses on what they call neural networks or simulation of neural networks, and it's focused on things like the brain and things like perception and recognition by computers and so on. Part of my position is that the two phenomena are one and the same, that what we're seeing at the micro level in the brain is the same kind of thing that we're seeing in society. And even seeing in different ways, different places in society. The same principles that govern crickets interacting with each other, that govern bloggers citing and quoting each other, that govern the development of river systems and trees, those principles are also the principles that govern things like human brains and computer networks set up in certain ways. Now, the interesting thing, and the reason why I've taken the tack that I've taken, and the tack that I've taken in this particular paper or this particular presentation, is now we have a network here, a network there, a network there, a network there, a network there, we have brains, we have society and all of that sort of thing. And how do concepts go from one of these networks to the other? Because, and this is where we get to connectivism, the whole point of teaching, isn't it, is to get some sort of knowledge, if you will, whatever you want to call it, from the big network, that's society, into the little network, that's the student's brain. But at the same time, we're also working on the problem of how to get stuff that's in the little network, say my brain, into the big network, society. And so we've got this process that goes back and forth here. And what's really important, it turns out to be crucial, is that this is not strictly a causal process. You don't just simply, you don't simply cause a pattern to occur in a straightforward X causes Y sort of thing. Me having a thought in my brain and then saying it publicly, like here, doesn't automatically cause that thought to be part of the wider social network. And so we need to understand what that process is, how concepts go from network to network. And the beginning steps of that is to understand what a concept in a network is to begin with, and that's why I've taken the approach that I've started with here. So we get to the point, concepts are not words, and we got to get away from that idea of talking about concepts as though they are words. Concepts are patterns. And so the properties that concepts are going to have are not going to be logical or syntactical properties, they are going to be network properties. So that's how I would answer that, George. How did that work for you? Yeah, that's exactly right, George. I'm going to try to just drop my volume a wee bit here. I'm getting into the red zone. There we go. How's that? Yeah, I think that's better. Now, I mean, the way our discussion went, we started talking about the properties of networks. And so what are those properties? And the significant property that I want to talk about here is self-organization, or structure. And I'm tossing various words around. I'm trying to get you to have a picture of it in your mind, right? Not a word. And I'm quoting here from Christian Huber. Self-organizing systems acquire new structure without significant interference from the outside. They exhibit qualitative macroscopic changes such as bifurcations or phase transitions. And it's kind of interesting, if you have an interest in astronomy, at the moment of the Big Bang, there was one of these phase transition things. And so at the very edge of the galaxy, you've got this ripple pattern, which is sort of the ripple that occurred in the Big Bang. Why did it occur that way? Well, it just did. The way things connect with each other is reflective of the properties of those things. Different things connect in different ways. So here we've got a diagram of various molecules composed of oxygen and nitrogen and sulfur? Whatever. Silicon? No, that's not, I've always forgotten. And so, oxygen will connect to nitrogen in certain ways, but won't connect in the same way to hydrogen. And so we get distinct kinds of networks. People talk out there about networks as though it's like this unary phenomenon, right? The network has such and such properties. But different networks that are composed of different things have different properties. Networks don't obey syntactical rules. They don't obey things like modus ponens, which is the Latin name for the type of inference of the form if A then B, A therefore B. They don't obey principles of set theory or anything like that. They obey the laws of physics. And the laws of physics present themselves in interesting ways. For example, these force patterns in this construction. Networks, the organization of networks, is influenced by external stimuli. And that's why we get the whole concept of perception and learning and all of that. The actual structure of a network, the actual way a network is organized, the physical connections even between neuron and neuron in the brain is impacted by external phenomena. Now, that's not unique to human brains, if you think about it. A river system is a network. One of the external phenomena that affects the structure of a river system is rainfall. You get lots of rain, you get more rivers. You get less rain, you get fewer rivers. Another external phenomenon that impacts river networks is earthquakes or dams built by humans, all of these sorts of things. So the structure of networks can change according to the influence or the impact of external phenomena on networks. When human brains change their structure because of external stimuli, this phenomenon is known as plasticity. So we get many different types of networks. The network that people have been talking about a lot in relation to the internet is something called a scale-free network. And a scale-free network is a network that forms the pattern, types of patterns you can see pictured here. You see the river system on the one hand, and then you see the other scale-free network in the lower left-hand corner. It's the type of network that has these spokes and hubs, and you have one large hub and many spokes coming out of it. Like the Amazon River there, you have the Amazon River, which is really big. And then you have all of those tributaries that come off of the Amazon, and then you get to smaller and smaller and smaller tributaries. That's a typical kind of scale-free network. And on the internet, people like Clay Shirky and others have been talking about networks of this type and describing them in terms of power laws. A power law is a law, a diagram that describes the way networks look, and it describes networks where you have one, say, person with many connections, like an A-list blogger, like, say, Clay Shirky, and you have many people, very few connections, like, say, well, the rest of us. And all this discussion of power laws has been depicted as, well, that's just the way networks are. But what I'm trying to show here is that is not just the way networks are. There are different networks that are the result of different phenomena, the properties of the entities, the external influences, and physical laws. Different kinds of networks, moreover, detect or emulate or produce, different kinds of patterns. If you have a single layer network, you know, just one neuron and another neuron, you can detect binary phenomena, A or B. Something's off or on. Two layer networks can detect, you know, open or closed regions. Three layer networks, as the diagram shows, arbitrary forms and shapes. So again, you have different kinds of networks. And now you have different kinds of networks detecting different kinds of patterns. Well, what that means is, if what we're up to is pattern recognition, we build the network one way, we're going to get one kind of pattern. We build the network another way, we're going to get a different kind of pattern. So I'll pause here just for now. Oh, that's a great question. how do I want to phrase this? She's asking, you know, are networks sentient? And how do I want to phrase that? Let me bracket that and come back to it. I want to say, Karen, that they can be, but by sentience we mean a very specific sort of thing, which means that some types of networks with certain types of properties, will exhibit the quality that we call sentience. But not just any network will exhibit that property. Like a bunch of crickets chirping together, probably not sentient. Yeah, let's defer that. The question, because one of the questions that came up was, you know, do networks just detect patterns by themselves? That was, again, part of Karen's question, right? And it's interesting, then she asked, are they sentient? And two separate questions, right? And so I'm going to want to say that, yes, they do detect patterns by themselves, but there's a big but here, and the but just is the name of this title, the recognition factor. And so maybe I'll move from those questions into this next section and talk about recognition and the role that recognition plays. Synchronicity is just, it's a kind of property that occurs in certain kinds of networks. And if you look at a network, analyze a network, you have one unit, you have another unit, and they're connected. One unit fires off. The question is, does the other one fire off? And you get synchronicity if there is a propensity for the other unit to fire off, if the propensity for the other unit to fire off is greater given the first unit firing off than it not firing off. So, take crickets chirping, right? If a cricket is more likely to chirp when it hears another cricket chirp, then you're going to get this kind of synchronicity. If it's just crickets just chirp whenever, then you're not going to get this kind of synchronicity. Now, for those who have studied networks, that's a bit of a gloss, but it's kind of like that. So the question of whether you get synchronicity in networks fundamentally comes down to the properties of crickets, what kind of thing crickets are, what kind of entities in a network crickets are. That's essentially the answer to that. What I think is interesting, though, is the synchronicity in a network, all the crickets chirping, all in sync, all in the same pattern, is nothing more or less of anything. It's nothing in itself. And that's what I want to get at this particular juncture. Let's look at the network that forms the human brain. Again, the nature of the human neural network means that we create patterns in the mind in certain specific ways. You look at the neural network for visual pattern recognition. We're set up in such a way that when we get visual phenomena, we find patterns in that visual phenomenon. That's just the way human brain neurons work. And in particular, the way they work is edge detection. We see objects, we distinguish objects one from another because that's how the layers of human cells connect to each other. So that, you can think of it as a representation, right? Sixth or seventh layer of the retina, what that layer is doing is finding a 2.5-dimensional representation of a physical object. The thing is, though, in the case of pattern recognition, there's more going on than simply the input phenomena and then the processing of that phenomena to produce patterns. If you look at the examples here, the face of Jesus on Mars, or the face in I forget the name of that cloud that was detected by Hubble, or even the Virgin Mary on the side of the museum there. we see patterns. Our minds are pattern recognizers, but we see patterns in everything. And whether or not the pattern is actually, shall we say, in that thing. Now what's happening here, and George, you alluded to this earlier, is that we, the recognizer of the pattern, are bringing something to the equation. And pattern recognition is not simply the matter of the input phenomena at a given point in time. There's a very famous example. Many of you have probably seen this. What is this? Is it a duck? Or is it a rabbit? Really, it's a perceptual phenomenon that has been placed in front of us, and so we're seeing a certain pattern, and our minds are divided. Which way do we go on that? If we interpret that particular phenomenon one way, if one set of connections becomes prevalent in our mind, becomes more active or more activated, then it's a duck. And if a different set of connections becomes more activated, it's a rabbit. Our interpretation of whether it's a duck or it's a rabbit depends on the prior organization of our neural net. It depends on the prior organization of the network. The network has a tendency to interpret things one way or another, because remember back from the earlier parts of this discussion, right? All of the different concepts that we have are all sitting there in the network. They're all overlapping and interweaving with each other. And so when we're presented with a new phenomenon, we have a tendency to interpret it one way or another way. We can describe this as energy states of various neural net configurations. And so it's like our perception of something is attracted by one of our prior or previously existing conceptions. Associative memory is equivalent to patterns, and not patterns, patterns of connectivity, which is the creation of attractors, the creation of prior candidate patterns, which is, in a word, recognition. To put all of this in slogan form, and keeping in mind that this is in slogan form, knowledge on this theory is like recognition. Learning is like perception. It's the acquisition of new patterns of connectivity, new attractors, new ways of seeing new phenomena through previous experience. Now this is a phenomenon you've seen before. This is nothing new. You see this every day when our brain snaps into one of these patterns. And Tom Haskins, just picking up on some of the discussion that we've been having in this conference, puts all of this in a post that he calls emergent learning. And all of these things, that now I get it. Ah, it leapt to me out of the blue. My mind leaped to something. I did an about face. Or even like the conversion of Paul on the road to Damascus, right? These are all pattern recognition phenomena. Knowledge is recognition. It's like a belief that you can't not have. It's like after you found Waldo in that picture, you can't look at that picture and not find Waldo again. I'll pause there. you say, do we have a clear understanding? I wouldn't say that there's a generally accepted consensus. Here's my take. Because there are different types of neural networks, again, these are described in the connectionist literature, and I'll describe three types of networks. One is the simple Hebbian associationist network. That's where if two neurons fire at the same time, the connection between them is strengthened. If they don't fire at the same time, it's strengthened, but if one fires and the other doesn't fire, then the connection between them is weakened. All right, so that's your pure, if you will, inductive perceptual knowledge, right? You just draw in associations from the phenomenon. Another type of neural network learns not simply through Hebbian association, but through what is known as back propagation. Now, this kind of neural network presumes a desired or expected end state. And so what happens is, you have a perception, you get input into it, you form your connections, you create your output, and then your output is either accepted or rejected. And if it's rejected, then this rejection propagates back through the network and weakens all the connections that led to it. A simplification, a gross simplification of this might be the pain response, right? You see something, ooh, fire, and your brain goes ding, 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 forms a set of connections, and the output is you touch the fire. You feel pain. Now you're getting back propagation. And all the things that led you to touch that fire, are all those connections are weakened in your mind. That's the second model. A third model is one known as a Boltzmann net, a Boltzmann neural net. And the idea here is that you have all your connections, all of your input comes in, your connections all form, and it's kind of like, you drop a rock into the pond, and the ripples flow back and forth, and they go back and forth, and then they kind of settle into, and the pond gets flat again. Well, the mind does that sort of thing as well, on this theory. So you get the perception, and your mind is all agitated, and so now you got some neurons are strong, some they're firing off like crazy, some connections are strong, and all of that, and your mind is all out of balance. And you go through a process where your mind settles into a stable configuration, except that it can't just simply settle into a stable configuration, because the stable configuration that it settles into might be what is called as a local minima. It's a stable configuration, but it's not the most stable configuration. So you agitate the mind. And the principle would be, you're sitting there, you're resting, you're reflecting. What you're doing is shaking up your mind, like a dream experience even, if you will. And then you shake the mind, and then it settles again, but into a more stable configuration. That's a process known as annealing. My expectation, and I think this is reasonably supported in the literature, is that the processes that result in the organization of the neural net, the human neural net anyway, is a combination of all of these processes. And that's why when I say to learn is practice and reflection. It's practice and reflection. You need not just the associationism, not just the back propagation, but you also need that time where you're settling into stable states. You need that annealing time. Okay, cool. So what we've got here is a theory where knowledge and learning is a process of pattern recognition. And no, this is not slide 30 of 100. It's slide 30 of 31. No, I'm just kidding. Pattern recognition isn't one of these hard and fast things. Pattern recognition isn't, as I said in that slogan form earlier on in the talk, it isn't based on identity. It isn't based on equivalence or equality. It's based on similarity. Something is more similar to something than something else. So you recognize the pattern of 9 in the phenomenon. What you're doing is you're comparing the phenomenon with other patterns that you have in your mind. In this case, you know, the previous patterns 0 through 9, and the current pattern is most similar to the one that we represent as 9. And what we want when we're talking about learning is for students to recognize patterns in existing networks. For example, communities of practice, communities of experts, the sorts of things that we talked about as instantiating knowledge in society. We want them to be able to recognize patterns in those networks. So we want the student to look at a phenomenon in society, say a physics experiment, a discussion among physicists, and indeed novel phenomena, things that they haven't seen, and be able to reliably extract patterns from that. We want to go from the community, and here I'm pointing, you can't see me, but I'm pointing at those three scientists there, those three stereotypical caricatured scientists, from the community to the pattern recognition to that aha moment where our understanding snaps into place. We see the pattern. We connect what we've seen in front of us with some knowledge or some pattern that we already have. But the thing is, we need to, you know, as I said, different networks produce different patterns. So, you know, we can put one kind of network in front of students and get one set of results. We'll put another network in front of students, we'll get another set of results. And for that matter, we're in this network. You know, we are the experts that are the network of experts. And so, you know, and we want to produce knowledge in our network. We want patterns to emerge in our network that are good patterns. We'd rather come up with the theory of gravity than, say, the theory of impulses, or impetus, I never know how to pronounce that. We want to be able to maximize knowledge. So what kind of network do we want to build? Well, I've drawn two extremes here. And this was the aha moment for me. I remember, it was what, 1989, 1990, something like that, and Francisco Varela was giving a talk on immunology at the University of Alberta Hospital. And I attended that talk. And he drew the whole chart on the wall, and little connections among entities, and you get too little connection and information never propagates. There's no communication one neuron to the next neuron. But on the other hand, if you get too much connection, information propagates too quickly. If everything is connected to everything, then we are overwhelmed. Or we just assume any time we get a new perception, that just overwhelms everything else. So what we're after is a type of connection that's going to fall somewhere in the middle. A type of connection that is going to offer us reasonably stable attractors as patterns to recognize in the phenomena in front of us. Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about things like the internet and web 2.0 and all of that. And part of what I say is that the internet itself illustrates a sound set of these principles. The internet itself is sort of a network that at least allows us to experiment with the sorts of patterns that lead to reliable knowledge and the sorts of patterns that don't. And we've had the opportunity now for a number of years to study this. jumping and leaping, you know, across a wider set of inferences here. But I've argued elsewhere that the types of networks, the networks that we would class as reliable or effective, instantiate certain properties. They're decentralized. So they don't actually resemble that star cluster format that people like Clay Shirky characterizes. They don't create these power laws. They're distributed. They're not all in one place. They're disaggregated. They're composed of separate components. They're disintermediated. Things can communicate directly with each other. They're dynamic. They change and rechange. In other words, they're plastic, the way the human brain is plastic, allowing connections to form and to unform. They're disintegrated. It's not all one single system, but in fact it's various subsystems. Jerry Fodor captures this in a book that I mostly disagree with called The Modularity of Mind. They're, if you will, democratic. The democratic principle is a special principle. I call this the semantic condition. And networks that follow these properties are networks that are going to give us more reliable information, more reliable knowledge, patterns that we can depend on rather than patterns that lead us astray. These reliable networks are networks that support or that instantiate autonomy. Each entity in the network functions on its own. It makes its own decisions. It does its own thing. Diversity. The networks are not made up of the same kind of thing. The entities don't all have the same properties. They don't all have the same values. Openness. The network admits external phenomena that will help shape it. And then connectivity. The networks, the entities in the network are, in fact, connected to each other. And Kathy Shields has nailed it. Not all patterns are valuable. Some of them aren't. Some of them are. Some of them aren't. And so what I'm describing here is the way of producing patterns that is reliable, as opposed to producing patterns that are not reliable. So we get, now we come full circle, right? How is this practical? You know, people are talking about, well, you know, we have the old theory of knowledge and rules and all that, but it's practical, it works. Well, this is practical. How is it practical? Well, go back to the example I raised at the beginning of this talk. To teach the concept of brackets, would you use the same example over and over? Why not? Now we know, because of the need for diversity. Diversity produces, more reliably produces, patterns that can be trusted. Diverse experiences create better networks than monotonous experiences. And so what you have here now is a set of principles. This set of principles you can apply to your current practices, what you do in the classroom, the type of software that you use, the way you organize a discussion group, or a conference, or a company, and these principles, if followed, produce more reliably effective companies or learning or classrooms or whatever. So for any one of these things, you look at the example, you look at the proposal, and you ask, is this distributed? Yes, okay, that's better. No, okay, that's not so good. And so now you have, if you will, a rubric or a metric against which you can evaluate existing practice and proposed future practice. And that, in a nutshell, is the proposition I wanted to put before you today. And so I thank you. I think what's changed is, you know, especially for those of us who are like the people in this conference, I mean, we've got this really big, huge network that we can all see pretty clearly, pretty much for the first time. We never had networks like this before. Certainly not networks that we could get at. Now, you go back to some of the early experimentations in social network that are described by Watson, Barbarossi, and others. How did they test the 6 degrees phenomenon? The 6 degrees phenomenon, right, is any person in society is six steps away or six connections away from any other person in society. Well, what they did is they mailed out letters and asked people to send letters to their friends to try to get the letter back via the connections between friends to the original source. And actually, a whole bunch of those letters got lost, and nobody knows what happened to them or anything like that, but some of them made it back. But this is the technology they're using. There you go, them letters. And you can't study networks using letters. You can't study networks using the postal system. It's just, you know, not reliable enough, and it's not fast enough. You can't grasp it. You have computational power now. We can actually create networks that we couldn't create before. We can actually simulate connectionist systems, simulate you know, patterns of interactivity between neural networks that we never had before. So what we have are ways of seeing that we didn't have before. And because we have these new ways of seeing, that allows us to look at the same phenomenon, but from a different perspective. It allows us to use the metaphor that I raised at the beginning of the paper, it allows us to tilt our head in a certain way and see what we've always seen from a different point of view. And seeing it from this different point of view allows us to detect different phenomena in the same perceptual experience. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by abundance. Do you mean by abundance? Do you mean density of connectedness? That's an interesting question, because it depends on how you look at it. I mean, the learners, the individuals that we have in society that are acquiring this information, are the same physically as they were before. They have the same sorts of eyes, the same sorts of ears, and therefore the amount of information that's coming into a person in 2007 is pretty much exactly the same amount of information that's coming in 1907. You know, you see, you hear. And so the question is, you know, more along the lines of where this information is coming from, the type of the network that is producing this sort of information. And if you look at the structure of networks through history, you'll find that the connectedness is increasing, but also too that the shape or the structure of the network is changing. And again, we come back to these power laws, right? Well, in 1907 we had pretty extreme power law, where a few people would have, you know, influence over a great many people, and the great many people would have influence over very few. And you know, the classic example of that, we saw that come to fore in things like broadcasting, where you could have an Orson Welles or somebody broadcasting to 20 million people. It's the center of a very large star. And over time, these big spikes are getting smaller. You look at the A-listers on the internet today, and these A-listers are talking to audiences of what, 10,000 people, 20,000 people. In very rare instances will they get up to the millions of people, and then only for instances. So what we're seeing is a change in the nature of the connections. We're seeing an increasing, if you will, modularity. We're seeing an increasing focus on smaller but more dense sets of connections among, I don't want to say groups, because I don't mean groups, but among collections of individuals. We're seeing more of an equal distribution of connections from person to person. To put it in slogan form, our networks are becoming more democratic. And it's more reliable. So it's not a question of the amount of information. The amount of information is, to my mind, almost irrelevant. It's the way this information is organized, the way this information is transported, the way we set up the system that passes information from one person to the next. And as the influence of any given source decreases, the reliability of our network increases. And there are so many historical examples of that, which I won't get into here. That's the end of our recording, and they're going to talk about Second Life now.